I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is smoking. It was not long ago that you could be watching TV and you would be inundated with ads for cigarettes. As the tobacco industry was a powerful player both in the cultural and economic life of Canada, and frankly, still is. But the number of Canadians who smoke each year continues to decrease, and there are efforts to continue that trend, as the harm done to an individual's health through cigarette smoking has been well established. But that causal connection was not always accepted by the general public, given the powerful social place of smoking in Canadian culture. And that is the topic of a wonderful book by Daniel Robertson entitled Cigarette Nation, Business Health and Canadian Smokers, 1930 to 1975, in which Daniel goes through and traces this process through which the causal link between lung cancer and cigarettes was being established by the medical community, and the efforts taken by the tobacco companies to push against that, as well as the skepticism from the public. And in doing so, Daniel examines all the reasons for that level of skepticism, from advertising to the socio-cultural aspects of cigarette smoking, and how processes related to regulation all played out in real time. It's a wonderful study that looks at something that we, and I talked about this with Daniel a little bit, that here in 2024, we can look at smoking and there's a very particular, I think, way in which people consider it. And as Daniel talks about on the show, it was at times a very slow process. And there are people who are either outright ignoring the information or rationalizing their actions. And as he's talking, you can think of a lot of parallels to topics today, that scientific research comes out, there's seemingly consensus across the scientific community, and yet there are ways to rationalize actions that go against that. So for as much as this is a story of cigarettes, and a really well-told story of cigarettes and the power that they held and to a certain extent still hold in Canadian life, Canadian culture, a lot of the bigger ideas in this book are applicable to a wide range of topics and issues here in the 21st century. So I was very excited to have the opportunity to speak with Daniel. Very much enjoyed the conversation. Think you will as well. So let's get right to my chat with Daniel Robinson. All right. And Daniel Robinson joins me now. Daniel, how are you today?
I'm doing fine.
Thanks for doing this. Looking forward to chatting with you. Again, we're talking about Cigarette Nation, Business Health and Canadian Smokers, 1930 to 1975. Daniel, I'm always curious where people get their interest from, where topics come out of, especially a topic that, I don't know if it's verboten. I think that's probably a bit of an overstatement, but you know, smoking has obviously the connotations to it. There's things that in the 21st century, when people think about smoking, there's an automatic, I think, perception that people have. So for you, as a researcher, historian, where did this interest in this particular topic come from? And have you noticed that when you tell people, like you're out at a party or something, someone finds out you wrote a book on cigarettes, do they have preconceived notions potentially about the topic or about generally what you do as a historian?
Well, when I talk to people about smoking, almost all of them are non-smokers nowadays, right? So yeah. It is kind of a lost world. A world in which smoking was commonplace. And that really was the world that I grew up in the 1970s. When I was a kid, both my parents smoked, my uncles and aunts, their friends, my parents' friends. It was just a common aspect of my life. I used to, as a 10-year-old, I would go to the store and pick up my mom's cigarettes. There was just so much social acceptance of smoking in that sense. And I saw that smoking played a very crucial role in terms of social interaction when I was young. I could see that with the adults in my life. And later, I came to think about that as I became older and then later as an academic, because that was the 1970s. And that was about 20 years after the science linking smoking to lung cancer had become established or was beginning to become established. So the question is, what is it about, in my case, a working class family, why were so many people still smoking 20 years after the science said it was a really bad idea?
And yeah, that's sort of a curious thing that I think there are a lot of parallels to certain things today, which we could talk about in a bit. I'm curious about that experience of it, because one of the things that it strikes me, you know, I grew up in the 90s and I remember like the tennis tournament was sponsored by Du Maurier, or all the ads on auto racing were all related to cigarettes. In your opinion, in your perception, how fast did this change happen that, you know, I could do a question like that and say, well, there's, you know, not a lot of people smoke. There's certain a perception to it, which is very different from the environment you grew up in. Strikes me as it's a very fast change. But for you, as someone who's researched this more in depth, like how would you assess the speed of the change that's happened?
Well, I would say it was a rather slow change. if you look at it from the standpoint of, the late 1940s, early 50s, about 60% of adults are smoking cigarettes in Canada. And then the lung cancer news starts to come about in the 50s. What you see from that is a kind of gradual decline in what we call the prevalence of smoking, the number percentage of people are actually smokers. But at that same time, you see an increase in per capita cigarette sales at this time. So what you have are more people becoming more regular smokers. I mean, smoking more often in terms of the number of cigarettes per day, even while the percentage of the smoking population declines. So by the early 70s, it's down to about 40%, but it really doesn't drop in a kind of way that you described in terms of your 1990s experience until the early 80s, where you start to see a number of things coming together in terms of having fewer and fewer people smoke, and you start to see the decline in the per capita cigarette sales.
So, but before we get into some of the drop, let's get into the early part of this book. And you start in 1930, an interesting point, of course, with the Great Depression and through the Second World War, before some of the links to cancer are really being made public in scientific journals. So why did you want to take a look at that era prior to the 1950s, the latter part of the second or the first half of the 20th century, in the early part of the book?
Well, paradoxically, the Depression years were very good years for cigarette sales, and even better than the 1920s, with the exception, I think, of 1932. From about 1930 to 1982, per capita cigarette sales increased every year, and they increased a lot in the 1930s. And this is also the decade when you start to see women becoming more acceptable as cigarette smokers. And so it opens up a new market in that sense as well. So by the late 30s, you could say that cigarette smoking was fairly socially acceptable, which was not the case, say, in the mid-1920s.
Once we get then into the 1940s, do we see rationing around tobacco in the same way we do butter and other consumable products?
No, in fact, just the opposite. You see the federal government subsidizing the sale of cigarette cartons for soldiers overseas, essentially waiving taxes on them. And you see a fairly strong effort to promote the gifting of cigarettes to soldiers overseas, and encouragement as well of smoking for people on the home front, especially if they were in the workforce and the factories, etc. And that was because smoking was thought to improve the productivity of people. And that was all seen as very important during the war, of course.
Is there any basis to that perception that it helps people be productive? Is there anything to it, or was it all just kind of narrative from tobacco company?
There wasn't a lot of science done on that very question, say, in the 30s and 40s. But I would, based on just the things that I read and people talking about their experience, is that if you are a smoker and you're accustomed to smoking a cigarette every hour or so, and you're not able to do that every hour or so, you become anxious, you become, you know, a little uneased with what you're doing. And so you're far more likely to be productive if you can have that cigarette. And what you actually see are a lot of workplaces become accommodating to cigarette smoking during the 1940s, whereas beforehand, that was not the case.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm a big curler, and you see old photos of on the curling ice. On ice, they have the ashtrays, which you would think that ice and smoking don't necessarily go together that well. But you would see that just again and how common it was. Was there ever a notion, because again, I grew up in the 90s and a lot of campaigns to not smoke, don't start smoking. Was there any idea of, well, if people are getting antsy when they can't smoke, what if we just create an environment where they don't start smoking? Was there any sort of anti-smoking or don't start smoking campaign in 30s, 40s in this era?
Not really. There was always a sense that young kids shouldn't be smoking. That goes back to the early 1900s in terms of thinking it's a bad idea for people who are preteens to be smoking and that. But what they found was that as you get into the 40s and 50s, the most common age for starting to smoke was the kind of mid-teen years, 15, 16, that sort of thing. And so once people become regular smokers by, the age of 18 or 19, it's a lot harder to quit, obviously, because they've been doing it for a while. And you're just far less receptive to an anti-smoking message when you're already a smoker. There wasn't really a lot in the schools that were promoting anti-smoking, say, to 10 or 11 or 12-year-olds. That comes much later, really not until the 70s, I would say, where you're seeing that consistently.
You mentioned earlier that there wasn't a lot of studies done, really any studies done too much about the connection between smoking and productivity. But then we get into the 1950s and we're starting to see scientific studies on the connection between smoking and cancer. So I'm curious as to what was the motivation for those? If smoking is this regular cultural thing, people are into it, people seem to like it, where does the motivation to study this connection come from? Like, are there increases in lung cancer rates? Is there a greater understanding of the disease? I'm curious as to what motivates medical professionals and researchers to start to dive into this area.
Well, there's a steep increase in lung cancer rates starting to be noticeable in the 1930s. And then certainly by the 40s, they're very noticeable. And there were a number of pioneering studies that were done that found an overwhelmingly strong correlation between those who acquired lung cancer, which was a fairly rare disease prior to the 1920s, an overwhelmingly strong correlation between those who got lung cancer and those who were, in fact, heavy cigarette smokers. Cigarette smokers, which is a far more lethal form of smoking than pipe smoking or chewing tobacco or things like that.
Yeah, because I mean, that's sort of, I think to me, a next question, that tobacco has been around for forever, right? A tobacco, people have used it for thousands of years. So what is it specifically about cigarettes that creates that connection that it makes makes them so much more harmful than regular tobacco?
Well, generally the tobacco that would be used for pipe smoking or even for cigar smoking is a type of tobacco that is not really designed to be drawn deeply into the lungs. It's too kind of harsh, and it's effectively something that mostly is inhaled into the upper respiratory tract or just maintained in the mouth. Cigarettes, with the advent of what was called bright leaf tobacco and a form of flue curing, allowed cigarettes smoke to be inhaled deeply into the lungs because it was a milder form of smoke. And by doing that, it enhanced the effect of the smoke. It enhanced the sort of feeling you got, the kind of hit you would get from the nicotine rush and that. So it could be drawn deeply into the lungs. It could then flow into the bloodstream a lot faster. And then it would also hit the pleasure centers in the brain a lot faster. So all of that meant the experience of smoking cigarettes was usually more enjoyable in that sense than would have been the case with those other forms of tobacco. It also meant because it was drawn deeply into the lungs, it was far more lethal in terms of things like lung cancer.
Right. So it's an improvement on the user experience in the short term that you enjoy the experience better, but in the long term, not so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So as this information, as people are learning this and making that connection very clear, how is that getting out? Because I don't know about you or all of our listeners, but I've not one to regularly read medical journals. And generally speaking, again, this is 21st century perspective, but when the news media reports on stuff from medical journals, I always find it somewhat not satisfying that there's always these caveats in there because that's the way it seems like medical research goes. So how is this information being publicized in the moment? And how are people, if they are at all, learning about this causal connection between cigarettes and cancer?
Well, starting around 1952, 1953, you start to see a fair number of news stories about medical studies that were showing this link. And generally speaking, the links that were shown were not so much in debate. You know, sometimes, you know, there's a small significance that is suggested by the effect of something. In the case of cigarette smoking and lung cancer, the evidence was quite overwhelming in terms of these studies. Now, having said that, because of the way that journalistic convention works, it's sort of wanting to be objective. And so you typically would have news stories about these studies linking smoking to cancer, and then you would have commentary from the tobacco industry in the same. And their position was always that those studies were incorrect, that they were false, that they were premature, that they were not, you know, the type of research that would need to be done. And they had all these kinds of arguments as to refuting that. So one could look at those articles and effectively pick out a part of it that might reassure, especially a smoker, might reassure them, oh, the science is premature. Okay, that means I can wait, right? There's a possibility that pollution is a factor in lung cancer rise, which is what the industry was saying as well. They would even say that there were viruses that potentially were at play and things like that. So a smoker is addicted. They may not realize that. They didn't necessarily talk about addiction and smoking in the 50s, early 60s. But they're motivated to look for rationales or reasons as to why they could continue to keep smoking, which, of course, is what they want to do, in part for pleasure, but also just for their staying part of their social world, sure. Right? Which is usually filled with other smokers.
Yeah. Now, are there studies being funded by tobacco companies to counter these? And what, the book talks about it. So there are studies that are funded by the tobacco companies that counter these. How are those conceived of by the tobacco companies themselves, the doctors who are putting them forth, and then received by the more independent medical professionals who are doing the other study? Like, what is that relationship like? And how do these things get published and then received?
So by the early 1960s, the consensus within people who research cancer, epidemiologists, and the strong consensus is that there's a strong correlation, a causal relationship between smoking, cigarette smoking, and lung cancer. However, there were some scientists who were producing research that was suggesting something else. Some of those, in fact, I would say probably a majority of those, were scientists who were being funded by the tobacco industry. There was a lot of that happening in the United States. We have all of these records now. The tobacco industry records have all been made public, essentially. And so we can see these relationships that were there in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so it was in the industry's, obviously it was in the industry's interest to fund research that would create doubt, right? Create skepticism on the part of smokers or prospective smokers.
Were they used by people basically to rationalize what they, like, if I'm a smoker and I can just say, well, okay, this guy says it's okay for me to smoke. Is that kind of what they were for? That the audience was basically to keep smokers as opposed to necessarily attract new ones?
Well, they were still doing both, but definitely keeping smokers in the ranks was important. Later, there would be a psychological theory developed. This was in the 1980s called motivated reasoning. And I think it applies very much to the way smokers approach the question of health risks around cigarette smoking. So a form of motivated reasoning would be that you don't just sort of evaluate the evidence and kind of rationally come to a conclusion. Rather, what you do is you have a preconceived bias towards what you hope to achieve. Yeah. You don't necessarily recognize the bias or are explicit about it. And then you basically develop a kind of way of assessing information that conforms to that bias. And you actually think what you're doing is objective and is sort of approaching it, you know, with a clear mind. And so somebody who picks out the odd study that suggests that smoking may be okay, and overlooks the dozens and dozens of other studies that say it's very, very harmful, effectively would be engaging in that form of motivated reasoning.
Now, one of the motivations that is talked about in the book is the cultural aspect of it, the social aspect of smoking. And you mentioned your experience growing up with essentially your whole family smoking it, be part of a social circle. And there have been, this has been a plot point on TV shows and sitcoms and stuff, but how powerful is the social connection to smoking through the era that you're writing about? And just how, because we're talking about something that is addictive, right? So you have the actual addiction that you have just to cigarettes, but then there's this other part of it. So how do you as a researcher try to weigh that between the physical need to smoke compared to the cultural and social desire to smoke?
I think they co-penetrated in the sense that, well, first of all, at that time in the 40s and 50s and even in the 60s, generally they didn't think of it as addiction, the same way that you could be addicted to heroin or something like that. They thought of it as a habit, that you were habituated to smoking. In that sense, they didn't see it in the medical kind of context that they might have seen something like heroin addiction, right? On the other hand, to be socially engaged, to be like a social being, to have a kind of context of friendships and outings and being involved with your family and all that stuff, typically that involved a lot of cigarette smoking. Mm-hmm. And so for a person, if they wanted to, if say somebody in 1960 said, you know, I'm really concerned about the health risks of smoking, so I'm going to try and quit. And that's physically quite hard. It takes, you know, lots and lots of willpower. Typically, people have about 8 or 9 failed quit attempts before they can actually get one that lasts more than a year. And so that's a physically demanding thing. And psychologically, it's also going to mess with you as well.
Yeah.
And then to put on top of that, the fact that, I really shouldn't be going out to my bowling league now because everyone there is smoking. And that's a problem for me. I can't be around smokers because it makes me want to smoke. What about going for Christmas to the in-laws? Well, they're mostly smokers there too. And on and on and on. And you start to think about the social difficulties around quitting smoking, and it would just make it that much harder to actually come to terms with quitting the habit for good.
Right. So the way you frame that is almost like a self ostracization of that and trying to separate yourself if you're going to try to smoke or try to quit smoking. Did you see cases in your research or see examples of people being pushed out of social groups because they don't want to smoke? Like, is there a negative reaction in some social circles or some parts of the country? I'm thinking especially maybe southwestern Ontario, close to where you are in that Tobacco Road area, Canada's little Tobacco Road that exists down there, that if you're quitting smoking in this era, people would push you out of social groups and not invite you to things.
Well, certainly there was some evidence of that in the sense that if your friends are smokers and you're hanging out with them and then you are trying to quit, you're a reminder to them of the kind of potential harm of that, right? So there was a sense that people were not always happy about having non-smokers or people that were attempting to become non-smokers amongst their social groups and that. And they also would and sometimes sort of dismiss people like that, saying that they were fear mongering, that they were people that were in the pawn. They were pawns of medicine, right, or doctors, and they weren't, you know, sort of can be even made into being a demasculinized kind of behavior, right? Afraid to take on risk or something like that. Right. So what you often see, though, is as you get a little bit later in time into the 80s, now there are more non-smokers out there, right? And so people are able to, they'll have friends who are smokers and friends who are non-smokers, and they can actually transition more readily into non-smoking circles. And it makes it easier to quit smoking in that sense.
Now, I want to talk about advertising because I am very intrigued by advertising. I actually have an old tin sign of Lucille Ball advertising cigarettes. I can't remember what brand. I just moved, so it's not up yet. And so I can't remember what brand it is. But I love that sign. I saw it when I was overseas, and I felt like I had to get it. It was €5 or something. So it's not an original by any means, but I really loved it. And all these old ads for cigarettes, that to me would have been the most fun part of this book in researching it. So I'm curious for you, just in the sense of the ads that you're looking at, how did you select or decide what ads or just trends in advertising to look at? Because the volume of things across the industry would be so grand. So just as a starting point, how did you try to address advertising and its role in this broader story?
Well, as you said, there's tons of advertising for cigarettes, really up until the 1970s. They were prolific marketers. In marketing, we talk about a kind of advertising to sales ratios and the percentage of your revenue, your profits that you then invest back in advertising. And for cigarette makers, it was high. It was over 10% for many of them. So there's lots and lots of advertising. But I was more interested not so much in like the volume of advertising. I was interested in how the advertising dealt with the issue of health concerns. And that's the key moment for the tobacco industry, the cigarette industries. You know, your product is linked to a form of cancer that has a death rate of about 80-90% at that time. Yeah. Well, you know, you could think, well, what do? Do we just pack it in, or do we try and come up with something else? But what they did was they engaged in what I call a strategy of hope and doubt. The doubt is on the side of them just being skeptical about medical science and just promoting a kind of discourse around the science is not proven, et cetera, like I said before. On the hope side, though, it was positioning cigarettes as potentially being healthier, certain brands being healthier than others. And so what you start seeing in the 50s is a lot of advertising that will focus on how cigarettes can be presented as being healthier, but without explicitly saying that, because if you explicitly say that, then you have to recognize that they're unhealthy, right?
Right, yeah.
And so you have the introduction of filters in the 1950s, and then advertising that talks about filters in terms of their ability to filter out impurities and other unwanted agents and that sort of thing. You start to see advertising that portrays smokers in kind of athletic kind of contexts and presenting smokers as being in the outdoors. You see more of this in the 70s, especially. And then ultimately, the advertising then has to, by the 1970s, by the mid-1960s, there's a recognition that since most smokers start in their teen years, you really want to have your brand taken up by those teen smokers. The evidence showed that oftentimes the first brand that you start smoking regularly, say when you're 16, 17, you're still going to be smoking that in the early 20s, right? In your early 20s. So the thinking was, okay, how do we then make them attractive to youth? But guess what? Our cigarette advertising code says we can't target youth. So what you end up with are not so much explicit advertising messaging that would be obviously geared towards people concerned with health or people that are, you know, are young people, or for example, you tend to see lots of symbolic communication, inferential messaging, and that sort of thing. And that way, in that sense, it's quite interesting how the advertising was able to connect with smokers and prospective smokers without obviously often being very explicit in terms of who they really wanted to connect with.
Yeah, because you remember all those, or at least I do, like ads, old ads that are like 8 out of 10 doctors smoke this brand, or like that kind of thing, right? That sort of is not explicitly saying it's healthy, but it's, well, if the doctor's smoking it, then it must be good. But in terms of some of those implicit messages to youth, what would an example of something like that be that is targeted kind of to the teenager, but not quite at the teenager? Like, what sort of messages would they be putting out?
Well, you mentioned early on the tennis tournaments and the Formula One races and that. Now, those were considered to be sponsorship advertising, so not explicitly brand advertising. But lo and behold, the sponsor names were the brand names, right?
Yeah.
So connecting your brand to say something like Formula One racing, and that would obviously tend to connect with young males more so than other demographic groups. And the research they did, the tobacco industry is they're fully aware of this, right? It's not just some happy, you know, confluence of, you know, doing this and that. So they're fully aware. They're extensively well researched in terms of the work they did, the consumer research they're doing. And so sports sponsorship would be one aspect of that. You see other types of conventional advertising that they'll show people, they're not allowed to show people under 25 in the ads, again, the cigarette code, but they'll show people that could be, they might be younger because of the way they present them, right? So officially they have to be 25 to be a model, but they might have a more youthful appearance. And they might be engaging in skiing or or playing tennis or things like that, that would suggest it might appeal to people who are young and want to emulate that.
Right. Yeah. And then you get stories too that always filter out in the press of like NHL guys who during the intermission would smoke this or like those sorts of stories, right? Have a beer and a cigarette before you go. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I'm a little curious about the people in this story, not necessarily in individuals themselves, because I know you talk about some individuals throughout the course of the book, but how you perceive of them as a historian and someone who's writing about this era, because I think it'd be very easy to be jaded and cynical about them and say they're putting out this advertising, they're funding studies that go against the medical consensus just to make money. And I could very easily just vilify them. I think that'd be a very easy thing to do. But how do you try to conceive of the companies and the people who are putting these things together and try to understand what their motivations are and situate them within the story?
Okay, on the part of government, the tobacco industry in Canada was centered in Montreal. Most of the time period I look at are the years when the federal Liberals were in power. Montreal was a key kind of center of Liberal power in this country as well. A vast majority of those seats would vote Liberal for most of those years. And so there was a recognition on the part of Montreal politicians, many of whom are in cabinet, say by the late 60s in the Trudeau cabinet, that we don't want to be doing things that are terrible for the tobacco industry. There are hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of jobs that would be lost if the cigarette industry were to collapse. So there's just one consideration in that sense. There's also an ingrained belief on the part of federal politicians, and I'm thinking here of the Liberal politicians in the Liberal years in the 1960s, that really the role of government should not be to prevent people from doing what they want to do if it can be legal, right? And so, this is the argument they made in the late 60s for decriminalizing homosexuality. Effectively, they said, you know, if they're consenting adults and they want to do this in their own time, their own privacy, the role of government is not to moralize about that or step in or criminalize it. And so they actually, and we see this in the cabinet records, they use a similar argument when they're debating whether to bring in restrictions on cigarette advertising in the late 60s, early 70s. They basically say, well, the role of government should be to educate, it should be to inform, it should not be to ban something that consenting adults are wishing to do. And so it's really the only sort of hero on the, say, the federal government side of this would be the Minister of National Health and Welfare, John Monroe, in the late 60s, early 70s. And he's a two-pack-a-day smoker that had tried to quit for a long time. And he realizes just how pernicious cigarette smoking can be and how, you know, there's no free will and agency involved in continuing to smoke. He said that Liberal argument really doesn't work with cigarettes. And so he tried and was able to introduce a bill that would have been well ahead of its time in terms of banning advertising and imposing other restrictions on the industry. But in the end, the Liberal cabinet overturned it, and they basically decided they weren't going to go ahead with that. So there's not really any heroes on the federal government side, I would say, until the late 80s. And it's really the Mulroney Tories that actually bring in real measures to curb cigarette smoking via restrictions on advertising.
So I guess that leads me to a bit of a question on whether or not the case of cigarettes is an example for the role government should or should not play in making any sort of assessments on the consumable products that people have access to. Like, what role, based on cigarettes, should the government have? Or is it free market, laissez-faire? Like how does this exemplify the pros and cons of government intervention where it does and does not exist?
It's a tricky question now, in part because we have a black market, a contraband cigarette market. And the estimates are that somewhere between a third, 40% of cigarettes in this country are being, procured on the black market. So the idea that you can ban cigarettes or impose taxes that are so high that they would put cigarettes out of the reach of people is a problem now, because there's alternative sources for cigarettes. So that's one consideration. And that black market has been a factor for the last 40 years or so. The other thing to think about, and I thought about this a lot during COVID, in the sense that it's often, it can be difficult for people to assess health risks. And we somehow think, well, you just have to tell people. You just have to tell people that, you know, COVID is going to kill, you know, 2 or 3% of the people who get it or something like that, whatever the number is. Or, you know, if you, in these contexts, you should be getting immunized, you should be getting vaccinated. Yeah. You know, there are all these things you can do. And we just assume that people will sort of take that medical advice and follow it. And my experience looking at cigarette smoking is it's not that. It really, it takes a long time for people to come to terms with medical science in that sense. So the role of government can't just be to say, we're just going to educate. If they do that, it means also you're going to have large numbers of people that are going to be injured or dead from particular types of things like smoking and that. So it's a dilemma, right? On the one hand, we are a liberal society and we don't believe in just, you know, infringing on people's rights and banning things. On the other hand, we can't assume that everyone is just going to come to a rational realization about the risk associated with something in a very short period of time.
Yeah, it's something I've read a little behavioral economics, and the idea of the rational consumer doesn't necessarily exist. The idea that that person exists doesn't really hold up when looking at a lot of the evidence on how people behave. And it's, yeah, it is an interesting question. Yeah, as you say, there's no firm answer on it. So I'm also curious, just as a final question here, the end of the book and how you bookend this particular story, because obviously cigarettes still exist. Whenever you're going into a building, you can see somebody standing outside smoking, and the cultural environment of smoking in the 21st century is so different. But how did you think to wrap the story and finish where you finish in terms of how you bookend this and why the subtitle has 1975 in it, and how you think of this episode in the history of smoking in Canada?
Well, I bookend it in a couple of ways. One is this through the story of my mother. I talk about my family at the start of the book, and then in the conclusion or the epilogue, I come back to my mother, who tried for about 2 decades to quit smoking and eventually managed to quit smoking sometime in the 1990s, and then later died from a type of lung disease. And I got to see what that means in terms of the hospital experience of that, in terms of what it means to gradually have the inability to breathe and that. It wasn't lung cancer, but it may well have been a type of disease that was made worse by those many decades that she was a smoker when she was younger. So it's a personal story for me in that sense. I end the book in the mid-1970s. In part, it sort of ends at the time when I was that 10-year-old buying cigarettes for my parents, and you know, I'm bookending it that way as well. I was born in 1965. It's really, it's the years after the federal government seemed to be ready to deal with the smoking issue, and in fact did not deal with it. And in fact, smoking rates continued to climb, or the sale of cigarettes per capita continued to climb throughout the 1970s. You don't really get into that next phase of smoking becoming delegitimized socially until I would say the early 1980s.
Really, it's a wonderful place to stop because of that. And there's so much in this era that you're covering, and so much that happens or that tees up to what happens later and the situation that we find ourselves in now. Because as we say, there's still a culture to smoking, and the perception of it has changed a great deal. And to get more on the background of that, a bit of that cultural history, really wonderful book, Cigarette Nation, Business, Health, and Canadian Smokers, 1930 to 1975. Daniel, what's the best way for people to grab a copy of the book and keep up with everything you got going on?
Well, if you just Google the title, it'll take you to about 3 or 4 different providers of those things. And certainly McGill Queen's University Press is the publisher of it.
Yeah, and we'll link to that down in the show notes below, so be sure to check that out. Daniel, I really appreciate the time today. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
So there you have it, my chat with Daniel Robinson, and I thank him for his time. Again, Cigarette Nation, Business, Health, and Canadian Smokers, 1930 to 1975. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from the BBC, Aurelia Foster, from April 23rd, 2024. What is the UK smoking ban? How will it work? and when will it start? This article goes through the new law that was put forth by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and voted on by MPs to create a smoke-free generation in the United Kingdom. So the way in which this would work is that cigarette sales, which currently you have to be 18 to buy cigarettes in the United Kingdom, starting in 2027, the age to buy cigarettes would increase 1 year, and it would do so every year. So in 2027, if you were born in 2009, you would not be able to buy cigarettes. So essentially, everybody born in 2009 and onward would never be able to legally purchase cigarettes in the United Kingdom. That's essentially how it would work. And this article gets into where the motivation for this law comes from, why MPs support it, the implications of what it means, including the government saying that it'll spend £30 million a year on enforcing this new law with fines of up to £2,500 for violations of the law. And of course, the article gets into the motivation for this, most notably the health risks associated with smoking. According to the UK government, a smoke-free generation could prevent more than 470,000 cases of heart disease, stroke, lung cancer, and other diseases by the end of the 21st century. Now, within that, of course, smoking rates are decreasing. In the UK, it's down to 13%, the lowest proportion of smokers since they started tracking in 2011. But interestingly enough, the highest proportion of smokers was the 24 to 34 age group. Smoking rates for older teens, those 16, 17-year-olds, were also pretty high. So this bill, this ban, is targeted towards those smokers and hopefully, in the government's view, reducing the long-term effects for younger people. It goes along with a similar law that was introduced by New Zealand, which was subsequently scrapped in November 2023. Canada is mentioned in this article, notes that the Canadian government is hoping to reduce tobacco use to less than 5% by 2035. And Canada was the first country to regulate that health warnings had to be printed on individual cigarettes, not just on packs. So a lot in here in the ways in which various governments, but in particular here, the UK, are trying to reduce the smoking rates to improve, obviously, health outcomes. But at the same time, there's a financial component to this. The national health system in the United Kingdom has had its struggles financially. So really, this is part of a preventative healthcare program in the United Kingdom and elsewhere around the world to hopefully reduce negative health outcomes. So today's historical headline of the week, Aurelia Foster in the BBC, April 23, 2024. What is the UK smoking ban? How will it work? And when will it start? And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe to the show, wherever you get your podcasts, likes, rates, comments, all that good stuff helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. Great written material over there. Plus all of our past episodes under the podcast tab. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's oldest news at gmail.com. So thanks again for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again real soon for more What's Oldest News.